From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, where will the next front line be in the war on AIDS in Wisconsin? We'll get some perspective. Then the challenges of integrating crime data analysis with stopping crimes on the street.
We know it's there, it's going to happen, but nothing happens. We give them predictions, put coppers out on the street, and nothing happens. And they say, that's all a bunch of BS, it doesn't work, and they go off and do other things. You've got to have patience because the numbers don't lie.
And the Milwaukee band Tallymore appreciates the traditional tunes it specializes in.
It's one of the brilliant things about some of these tunes is just like there's so much history behind them and you've heard so many different versions of it. And we want to not only keep true to what the actual tune is about, but at least put our own twist and spin and take on it.
Lake Effect comes your way next after news from NPR and Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. There is not much that politicians in Wisconsin have agreed on in the past few years. Few issues enjoy bipartisan support. But a key exception has been the fight against AIDS. Thanks to the sometimes understated political will of people on both sides of the aisle, Wisconsin has, by many measures, become one of the most successful states in helping people manage the chronic disease. Much of that success is due to the innovative work of the Milwaukee-based AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin, or ARCW, which employs what's known as the medical home model to reach and support AIDS patients in the community. Mike Gifford is president and CEO of ARCW. He joined us for the latest in a series of conversations recorded on the sixth floor of the University Club of Milwaukee. Welcome. Thanks for being with us.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
What is the storyline on AIDS in Wisconsin circa 2014? What are the successes and what are the challenges that you still deal with every day?
You know, the storyline, I think, is summed up by we are leading the country in the fight against AIDS, and there are great challenges that lie ahead. Wisconsin has distinguished itself in the fight against AIDS across America really in two ways. One, we have the lowest AIDS death rate in the country, which really means that people living with HIV in Wisconsin live longer than anywhere else in the country. And then secondly, for a person with HIV, the ultimate goal is to get to an undetectable viral load. It means their HIV is managed as effectively as possible. And at the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin, 83% of our patients have an undetectable viral load, much higher than the national average of 25%. So we're doing great.
An undetectable viral load does not mean that they are cured of the disease, though.
Doesn't mean they're cured of the disease. They still have HIV. There is no cure for AIDS. That's a very important thing for us to keep in mind. But it simply means that they are in care and treatment, and the care and treatment's working as best as possible.
Is it akin to the use of the term remission in other diseases?
I would suggest that it's not akin to the use of the term remission because you need to stay on treatment, and the treatment itself has a number of serious side effects. People with HIV tend to have higher levels of cancer, particularly women with HIV who are five times more likely to be diagnosed with cervical cancer, heart disease issues, mental health issues, including neurocognitive impairment much earlier in life. So not really remission, it's just successful treatment at that time.
ARCW is especially well known for its medical home model, and I was hoping you could walk us through the significance of the medical home model and why it's so appropriate in the context of AIDS.
That's a great question. You know, we are really proud of the fact that the ARCW HIV Medical Home is the first and only HIV medical home recognized by the federal government. We're grateful for the work of the Walker administration and the Obama administration coming together to get that recognition and new support for it. A medical home is simply a model of care where we're integrating health and social services to meet the comprehensive needs of our patients. So in the ARCW medical home, a patient can simultaneously access medical and dental care, mental health therapy, drug treatment, a pharmacy, all those healthcare services that we need them to be accessing to assure they get to that undetectable viral load. But we know one of the most significant barriers to successful treatment is all the social barriers to care, poverty and prejudice and hunger and homelessness. And that's where all of our social services are integrated. So we actually operate one of the largest food pantries in the city of Milwaukee to assure that our patients have the nutrition necessary to live healthy. We provide about $750,000 in rent assistance. We know that a person with HIV who is low income and who is hungry is going to have to be focused on putting food in their stomachs, and that may take priority over putting medicine in their stomachs. Same thing on the housing side. A person with HIV who's homeless is going to be seeking out a shelter, maybe rather than seeking out a doctor's appointment.
And this, in the case of ARCW, takes place largely all under one roof.
All under one roof, one integrated team of professionals. Doctors and dentists working together hand in hand with the pharmacist who's, you know, right on site, social work case managers, mental health professionals, literally standing in huddles throughout the day in real time, coordinating care, trying to identify the challenges that patients are facing and help to overcome those challenges.
The community that you serve, largely impoverished, it's dealing with a lot of different issues, high blood pressure, diabetes, any number of medical issues. How is your work with the AIDS Resource Center informed by the approach to other diseases in the community and vice versa?
I think that this really gets back to that medical home issue where all of the care for a single person is cared for with one provider and one team of healthcare professionals. It's interesting, in many other communities around the state and around the country, even for a person with HIV, they would go to one physician for their HIV care and a different physician for their primary care. And we bring those two worlds together, I think, in a good way. That's, again, part of the medical home, and I think that's beginning to inform care elsewhere. You know, there's a physician, a cardiologist that's really close to our cause and our organization, and he often comments about how this is how heart care should be provided. So I think in a lot of ways, HIV care is blazing the trail for healthcare in the future, knowing that if we can do it in a serious health issue like HIV and succeed there, that it'll be easier to succeed on some of these other chronic diseases.
Clearly, we have gotten a lot better at the medical aspect of treating AIDS since it first came on the scene in the 1980s. How much better are we at the other aspects, either the interventions or dealing with the social and discriminatory impacts of AIDS?
We're all grateful for the strides we've made in the fight against HIV medically, right? I mean, there really is hope for a long and healthy life for people with HIV right now if they get into care and treatment and if they stay on the medications throughout the rest of their lives. On the prevention side, we have made great strides on the prevention side. As an example of that, clean needle exchange. It has been operating in this state now for 20 years. We like to say that during that time, you know, society has gone on and succeeded. And, you know, the cows still give milk in Wisconsin, the beer is still brewed in Wisconsin, and we're excited that the needle exchange program has reduced new HIV infections among that community by 76% since it started. It's a stunning success. Other interventions, particularly for young people who are becoming newly at risk for HIV, aren't as strong and effective, largely because there's inconsistency around the public schools on how we're implementing that. Sadly, to the last point in your question, we've made precious little progress in the issue of stigma and discrimination against people with HIV and AIDS. There are a string of recent discrimination situations, patients who couldn't get their teeth cleaned by a dental hygienist, to patients who needed access to emergency housing and were denied it, to patients who are denied access to basic surgery.
You mentioned education, and if you were designing a curriculum that educated students, appropriate age students, yeah, about AIDS and AIDS prevention, what should kids be learning at this stage?
Yeah, you know, once kids get into middle school, they need to understand how HIV is transmitted. And I understand that's a controversial thing for a lot of school districts. But when you see that a quarter of HIV infections are among people that are under 24 years old, We need to start at that middle age school level to begin to educate our young people. They need to understand how HIV is transmitted sexually. As they move on in the years ahead, they're going to become more sexually active. And certainly how HIV is transmitted through drug use. One of the terrible things that society is facing right now is the heroin epidemic. The heroin epidemic is an epidemic that is among high school age kids and kids right out of high school, and with it are all the risk behaviors that could lead to the transmission of HIV. So we need to start with a real honest conversation about HIV prevention in middle school, and then we need to build onto it steps that you could take to prevent HIV, and then ultimately how you make sure that you're successful in care and treatment.
Is the heroin epidemic the next front line in the fight against AIDS?
The heroin epidemic worries me on a couple of fronts. I mean, one, it knows no class or income boundaries. Two, what we've seen in our state is a huge uptick in deaths, and they're very tragic deaths. They're among very young people who have promising lives ahead. And I'm very concerned that it could re-spike the AIDS epidemic because it is that same. Risk behavior. ARCW, I think, has taken a really enlightened approach to the heroin epidemic, working with Representative John Nygren from Green Bay and the Walker administration. We've recently helped secure passage of the HOPE legislation. The most important part of it from our vantage point is that there's a medication called Narcan. And if you give Narcan to somebody who is in the throes of a drug overdose based on heroin, it will reverse that overdose, literally bringing somebody back from the brink of death. And we've been operating that program since 2006. We have reported more than 2,300 saves, or instances where the drug was used to save somebody's life. And that's important to us because we're able to save that life and have that conversation about getting people into drug treatment, getting them off of drugs, and reducing their HIV risk.
You've had success in working with the Walker administration. You've had success in working with the Doyle administration. How have you managed to keep politics out of AIDS policy in Wisconsin?
We owe a great debt of gratitude to political leaders in this state who have focused on what is best to save people's lives. And at the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin, we are focused on outcomes, outcomes like lowest death rate in the country, highest level of undetectable viral load among our patients. And when we've been able to focus on that and set aside some of the peripheral issues of HIV, we've been able to succeed. And I give great credit to politicians of both parties who have stepped up and said, we're going to work in partnership on this one.
How has your ability to measure success changed in recent years?
Well, a couple of different ways. And one, ARCW has made significant investments in electronic health records and technology that has allowed us to more closely track the outcomes of the care and treatment we provide. And two, with the advent of new HIV treatment, it's actually easier to track the progress that we're making. And, you know, our most recent annual report was entitled Return on Investment, and that's how we look at the work that we do. We try to take some of the best practices in the private business sector and apply them in the nonprofit sector. So trying to assure that every investment made, whether it's a dollar that's raised through AIDS Walk Wisconsin or a dollar that is given to us by the federal or state government, is best used.
So who do you think you're missing at this point? I mean, who is out there that the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin isn't getting to?
We serve about 3,000 people with HIV on an annual basis, and our best estimates indicate that there's maybe another 1,000 people who could use our care and treatment services. A lot of those individuals may not even know they're HIV positive yet and therefore aren't going to be enrolling in services. So we really need to reach out, particularly among young people, sadly, particularly among people of color. HIV is a disease of disparity, a health disparity among the races in our society and in our community. So those are really where we need to focus more of our energy as we move forward.
The term I remember from years ago is the notion of AIDS as a stigma on top of a stigma. Is it still at that level?
I think in many areas of society, it still is that level. There's still a taboo around HIV, and you know that's based in people's thoughts about the LGBT community. Sometimes it may be based in some religious beliefs. And what we try to do at ARCW, I think we do it pretty successfully, is try to overcome that by honoring that, but setting that aside and focusing in on trying to control and end what really is the worst public health crisis of our time.
So is it harder to make the case for urgency when you are meeting with so much success? When you go out in the community at one level, you're saying we've had, you know, we've had great strides in dealing with this, but at the same time, we still need money to keep this going. Yeah.
You know, the success that we've had in the fight against AIDS does make the road ahead more challenging in a couple of ways. You know, sadly, the success we have on care and treatment has, you know, I think had the unintended consequence of people being less focused on protecting themselves from HIV. We unfortunately have young people who come to us who are newly diagnosed with HIV who think they're sort of this magic pill, and if I take it, you know, my HIV will be taken care of. And it's just not that simple. So that's one of the instances where our success has hampered future efforts. We're very grateful for the philanthropic community in the city of Milwaukee in the state of Wisconsin, who we believe, and I think it bears out, want to invest in success. And we're grateful for that investment. We see that investment ongoing. And with the challenges of trying to get all of our patients to an undetectable viral load, trying to get 1,000 more patients into care and treatment, trying to prevent another uptick in new HIV infections among our young people, I think there is enough really urgent challenge there that the philanthropic community hopefully will continue to rally around the fight against AIDS. I often say someday we're going to win the fight against AIDS, and let's win it first here in Wisconsin.
Well, Mike Gifford, thank you so much and best of luck with that.
Thank you very much for having us today.
Mike Gifford is president and CEO of the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin. Our interview was the latest in a series recorded at the University Club of Milwaukee. There is a link to more about ARCW, including the culmination of its 30th anniversary commemoration later this month at the Sharon Lynn Wilson Center, from a link at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. How crime data analysis is changing the face of law enforcement. That story when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. Over the last few months, there have been periodic outbreaks of violence in Milwaukee. Weekends or other several-day stretches with sudden increases in shootings or other criminal unrest. While those outbreaks are still often difficult to predict, the ability to forecast trends in crime has evolved a great deal in recent years, thanks to the work of crime analysts. That field is the fastest-growing wing of the crime-fighting equation, and its ranks include a growing number of graduates of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee's Department of Criminal Justice. Alexandra Snowden is an assistant professor of criminal justice. Ruben Burgos is a longtime veteran of the Milwaukee Police Department, who's now a senior lecturer in criminal justice at UWM. They joined me in the studio earlier this summer. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you, Mitch. Glad to be here.
What does a crime analyst do?
Well, they do. They provide actionable intelligence for the police department. At the local, the lower level, the tactical level for the police officers, they give us information on where the hot spots are, trends and analysis of what's going on that the officers and supervisors can use as actionable intelligence.
Now, you say actual intelligence, but intelligence has always been a part of police work, but this has changed to some degree. You're distinguishing things like hunches from hard data?
Yes. We've been doing pin maps and things like that for 20 years in the police department, as long as I can remember. But now it's factual. This is the data, today's data, last week's data, last 7 days, 6 weeks' data, exactly where it's happening, what time it's happening, the suspects, the cars, information that the police officers need right now to find the bad guy.
Well, and I think just about anybody who's watched a police show on TV is familiar with the pin map. You know, contrast, you know, this idea of like putting pins or drawing circles over places on the map with the kind of data that police now get from analysts.
So, for example, now some of the data that we look into is about location where some of the crimes have occurred. And so we can use this information about pinpointing where exactly some of the hotspots are in the areas and then follow up, as Ruben was saying, with further intelligence about why are those hotspots there and not elsewhere.
But presumably the data alone isn't enough necessarily to predict where the next crime will be. There have to be people on the force who know how to interpret this data, right?
Yes, that's what we're the analysts for. We ask them, you know, tell us where are the hotspots, and they access all the databases we have. We have numerous databases on the Milwaukee Police Department, record management systems, the CAD systems. They access all these programs, do their magic, and then they come out with some intelligence or some analysis. And give us what time and place so that we can put the police officers in the right spot.
Well, and so what are the kind of skills that someone who goes into this field has to acquire to be effective in it?
Well, they have to be very logical, intuitive, looking at what's going on there, have some access to the mapping softwares without the technology, and be able to politically talk to supervisors. Some of the problems is police don't like to be told by civilians what to do. And they're civilians. They're not police officers, and they have to schmooze the police officers. And that's part of the job. It works with the right personality.
Well, and that's an interesting point, because that's not always the kind of stuff that someone gets in an academic environment. But is it something that you stress to students who are coming up through the field, that they're going to be civilians working in a much different environment than if they went to some other kind of IT job, for example?
We do.
Yeah, how do you teach schmoozing?
Well, when we had the interns at the Intelligence Fusion Center, we would talk to them, say, you know, they ask us, what do they really want? They get this request for data information, and what do they want? And we'd have to talk, well, we think this is what they want. Make sure you ask the right questions, and then find out what they're looking for so you can help them get the right answer.
We also teach students how to be careful thinkers about we can show you where the crimes are, but you have to think further than just this map. You have to think, why are these patterns the way they are? And we also make sure that they understand that they need to take a project from the beginning to the end. And learning those skills in a classroom environment and then also having the exposure in a real-world environment using real-world data helps our students be very successful.
These are statistics, but the statistics are impacted by people, and people aren't always predictable, right?
One could argue that, but then on the other hand, our statistics would allow us to make some probabilistic predictions about when and where crimes would occur, and then we rely on hunches and further intelligence, as Ruben was saying earlier, about acting up on those probabilistic sort of occurrences.
Well, and if I read between the lines, Ruben, you were on the force for more than three decades. I would imagine there are a lot of people in the field of police work who, to put it nicely, might be suspicious of this kind of data.
Yes, especially, you know, when Chief Flynn came to the police department seven some years ago, he brought in the data-driven policing and a lot of technology. Well, police are resistant, and it took a little bit of time for our crime analysts to show them this is why it works. And eventually they did come, most of them came around and say, hey, this is some good intelligence, gives us a good leads. We still have to be out there doing the legwork, but it took some time to get the older officers to acknowledge that this is some good information for them.
Can you give us some real world examples of how this data work actually leads to changes in or advances in police work?
Real world.
Well, I mean, like, you know, yeah, I mean, give us an example of, you know, what hotspots really are and how they lead to, you know, differences in policing.
Well, we know that by looking at the statistics that these kind of crimes occur in certain times, locations. It affects staffing. It affects other units working together, the intelligence division, the vice squad, the gang squad. They all work together, and we see that the problem is. What is the actual underlying issues, drugs or gangs or whatever it is? We network. And that's where the intelligence has helped us. The problem over here is a burglary issue, but that's really a drug issue. So we work together. We reach out to other units, and we then become, you know, a better team, teamwork.
What are the challenges that people face time and again that you see, you know, you would have seen in the intelligence fusion unit, for example?
Patience. We know that the hotspot, say 27th and Main Street, and we know it's there, it's going to happen, but nothing happens. We give them predictions. We give, you know, put coppers out on the street, and nothing happens. And they say, that's all a bunch of BS. It doesn't work. And they go off and do other things. You got to have patience because the numbers don't lie. Statistics doesn't lie. It's going to happen. It's just we have to be patient in that sometimes we know the crime's going to be. We assign people there. It gets bored. They want to do the real policing and run around chasing people, and they leave. They don't put the effort in.
Who are the kind of people that go into this field? Is it people that are interested in police work, people that are interested in statistics, some combination of both of them? Who's the right person for the job?
Some of the successful students that I've had in the past were simply very curious individuals that wanted to answer questions about the areas or the types of people that become apprehended for criminal activity. And so it's students who are curious about numbers, about working with numbers, but also are curious about and interested in making a difference in improving communities.
I've noticed also some of the my students who don't want to be actual police officers, but they do want to help. They want to influence in their community. What can they do and not be a police officer? And this is a very good way to help, and it's a nice career.
This is like an ability to help solve crimes without necessarily the danger of being shot at.
Correct. And the hours and the cold and all the elements out there, being out in the elements.
How much difference does it make in terms of timing of response? You know, we keep hearing about, you know, this was a violent weekend or it's been a violent couple of weeks in Milwaukee. How is it different today when something like that happens versus, say, 10 or 15 years ago from the standpoint of, response times, quickness to be able to analyze these patterns?
Well, we know that the areas where the problem is going to be, we put the police officers in the area. If when it happens, the shots fired, they go off, we have police officers in those neighborhoods. They just have to be redirected to those locations. We know that for the most part, people don't call the police when there are shots fired through some of the technology we have. But we know that if they see the police, they'll notify those police officers. So it really helps having the police officers in the neighborhoods where they're needed. And then the people then they feel they can call and contact those individuals.
The violence and violent crimes have been declining across the United States, and that's one thing that we keep forgetting about. But because we want response that's quick and we want to do things that can prevent further violence, we want response very quickly, even though violence as a whole across the state, across the nation, has been on decline.
There has always been statistical analysis, and people have always been smart. So what has happened in recent years to make this field more effective? Is it just computer technology?
I think it is a reason is computer technology, but the second and I think more important reason is availability of data. We live in an information age where we have so much data, and we need to figure out how to sort through all of this mass amount of big data to make important policy implications, prevent crimes from occurring and things like that. But it could be also developments in computer technology.
Well, you know, like you said, the access to technology, you know, the criminal is not going to stay in Milwaukee. They're going to go to West Dallas, to Whitefish Bay. They're going to go all over the country, over the state and county. And we now can act, the analysts can access this information through the databases. They get access to the state databases, the drug databases. And if you know how to use them and pull from them, and that's what our analysts do, they can get a lot of information that we never got before because we didn't have access to the county sheriff's database. We didn't have access to the state Department of Criminal Investigation database. And that's where the technology has really helped us to reach out to other avenues of intelligence that we weren't accessing unless it was a personal phone call or email or phone number or something like that would call.
It certainly, I mean, the other comparison I would imagine is to like electronic medical records, the ability that a doctor has to see everything that a patient has gone through. This is now something that police investigators have access to as well.
Exactly. And then we ask our analysts to make sure they understand what databases are available to them. There's lists and lists of databases that we have access to, not just public databases, also the restricted databases for law enforcement and other things that we have. And we have analysts who work with the federal government who can give us classified information also.
How is this field growing at UWM? What sorts of opportunities are there for students to learn this stuff?
There are vast, especially within our school. At the undergraduate level, we have several important developments where students can earn a certificate, a specialization, or a minor. And also, the latest exciting development is within our master's degree. We have plans to put forward a master's degree with concentration in crime analytics as early as this upcoming spring. Those are the plans.
The job field is wide open. The police department in Milwaukee is just hired three analysts this year. All over the country, every department realizes the value of crime analysis, and they're going to start hiring more as these graduates come through with these degrees, certificates, and minors. It's a great field for someone who doesn't actually want to be a police officer but wants to really make a difference in the community.
Well, Ruben Burgos and Alexandra Snowden, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you
very much, Rich.
Alex Snowden is an assistant professor of criminal justice at UWM's Helen Bader School of Social Welfare. Ruben Burgos was an investigator with the Milwaukee Police Department for more than 30 years. He's now a senior lecturer in the criminal justice department. Our interview first aired in July. The immigration crisis involving thousands of undocumented immigrant children has largely fallen off the front page. But as Lake Effect essayist Abby Lank notes, that doesn't mean it's gone away.
The mountains of northwestern Guatemala are among the most awe-inspiring places in the world. They feature lush, rugged valleys with fast-flowing rivers and streams and peaks that soar above 12,500 feet. For more than 30 years at the end of the last century, these highlands were the cockpit of a fierce civil war, whose savagery stood in stark contrast to their heavenly beauty. Today, the area has been pacified, and the residents have a large degree of local political autonomy. Most speak dialects of Mayan as their first, and in many cases only, language. Earlier this year, I had the extreme good fortune of traveling there with members of the Milwaukee Rotary Club to inspect some infrastructure projects Rotary has supported. To get to one, we passed through a verdant meadow that looked like it could have been in the highlands of Scotland rather than Guatemala. Mosses and grasses covered rocky outcroppings, streams trickled through, and large boulders occasionally dotted the landscape. Sheep silently grazed. And our party stopped for an idyllic picnic lunch, using peanut butter brought from the U.S. and other supplies purchased in the mountain town of Nabah, which served as our base. Then we saw the shepherds. Two ragged children, the older probably no more than 10, and a rangy dog. It was a school day, but these children had other priorities. As we sat on boulders, eating, basking in the sun, and enjoying the scenery, they stayed shyly away, until we offered to share our lunch with them. This they gladly accepted, putting the food aside, either for later use or to take back to their homes to share. When I gave one a large red apple, her eyes opened wide. It, too, was saved, and I heard her tell the other shepherd, in Spanish, that it was like a store had come to them. We then said goodbye, climbed into the massive vehicles we were using to make the trip, and went on our way. The World Bank says the Guatemalan highlands are an area of extreme poverty, and that is apparent to those who look. Many of the towns we went through had more women in them than men, and dollar remittances from immigrants to the United States form a huge part of the economic base. Almost every immigrant has a deep attachment to her homeland, and when that homeland is as beautiful and family-filled as the Guatemalan highlands, that attachment is completely understandable. Yet immigrate these Guatemalans do. Recently, many young people from the highlands and other areas of Central America have been flooding the southern U.S. border. The trip is dangerous and at the end filled with uncertainty and, from some, a distinctly unwelcoming attitude. These unaccompanied child immigrants are being used by some politicians to stir up resentment among their supporters. This is an insult to the humanity of the immigrants, the humanity of the politicians, and the humanity of their supporters. Put yourself in the shoes of the parents of those shepherds. Think what it must be like to agree to send such children on the perilous journey north alone. Helping to improve conditions in Guatemala is part of the solution to this dilemma, but only a very small part. Overall, I don't know the solution, either for the Guatemalans or for those of us up here. I do know that when the inspection tour was over, I boarded a plane and was back in Houston in about 3 hours without having to bribe a border guard or risk my life on an open train. And I know that some of my ancestors came to North America as unaccompanied children.
Lake Effect essayist Avram Lank was an award-winning reporter and columnist at the Milwaukee Sentinel and Journal Sentinel for more than 3 decades. He lives in Whitefish Bay, and his freelance work has appeared in a variety of publications. One last break, and then we'll meet the members of Milwaukee-based Tallymore and hear a few tunes recorded in our performance studio. It's Lake Effect from WUWM. More of Lake Effect now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. The members of the Milwaukee band Tallymore have been playing together since 2012. They call themselves a contemporary folk band, and since that first performance 2 years ago this month, they have basically not paused for a second, working towards a goal of becoming Milwaukee's go-to Irish band. One of the things that distinguishes them is their strong vocals. All of them sing, and 4 of the 6 sing lead parts. Right now, it's Ryan Kappelman singing lead in their arrangement of the traditional tune, The Fields of Athenry.
It's so lonely around the fields of Athenry. It's so lonely around the fields of Athenry.
The Fields of Athenry with Tallymore in Lake Effect Studio C1. Lady and gentlemen, welcome to the show. Thank you for that lovely performance so early in the morning.
Thank you.
It's just so great to meet you finally and hear about you. Let's start with introducing yourselves and what you do in the band. And Dave, I'll start with you.
Okay, I'm Dave Kennedy. I play acoustic guitar, electric, and throw in a little vocals here and there.
Matt Vohl, guitarist and percussionist and singer.
Carl Suchting, double bass, and once in a while vocals as well.
Hi, I'm Aaron Hoffman. I play violin, and I sing sometimes as well.
I'm Sean Ward, and I play mandolin, percussion, and I also sing.
And I'm Ryan Kappelman, and I sing, play piano, and do auxiliary percussion and bring energy.
I like the auxiliary percussion. That's good. You guys got together about 2 years ago, right? And how did it happen? Tell me the little history of the band, because it's not that long at this point, but hopefully a lot longer.
Yeah. We all met in our different ways as band members meet along the journey of meeting people. And pretty much it came to the point where we said, hey, would you be interested in playing in an Irish band? Sean and I grew up within the Milwaukee Irish Festival for many, many years, almost to the point that we considered each other brothers through good times and bad. When we realized that we wanted to continue our music journeys after we aged out of the youth choir, we said, you know, let's start a band. And we started off as an a cappella group and then said, we just are itching to pick up some instruments. So we picked up some instruments and met some other lovely folks along the way. And that's the group you see in front of you right now.
So that was in 2012, was sort of the formal time when you all got together as Tallymore?
As this group, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And did that happen at Irish Fest? Do I understand that right?
We all kind of met in different places. I think the first time Dave saw us, we were playing at the Christmas concert for the Irish Center. And he liked what we were doing and came up to us after the show and said, I heard you guys are looking for another member. So we gave him a chance, and luckily it paid off big time. So Erin, I think she just showed interest right off the bat, and she was full go from the start. And Ryan, I think Matt knew him.
I met Matt through youth theater, And I actually got to kill him in a production. It was pretty fun.
I know you're trying to recreate that ever since.
No, never, 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 never.
And then Carl, we met on Craigslist. So kind of all over the place, really. So you meet people in interesting ways and kind of all across the board.
But yeah, I think Irish Fest was our debut.
Yeah, it was with all the people you see here. That's probably Irish Fest was the first time we kind of all got together.
And it kind of hasn't stopped. I mean, you got together and it really took off.
Before we even knew it, we were able to obtain gigs pretty much all around the country. And we realized, man, we were here before we even knew it.
What do you think it is that people are responding to? You know, there are a lot of modern Irish groups out there. What is it about you guys do you think that people are gravitating toward?
I listened to this group, as Sean said, at the Christmas concert at the Irish Fest Center about a year ago. And I was completely blown away by their vocals. I was sitting at a table with a few other couples, and they did a version of Parting Glass. There were people crying at the table. I think vocals is a big strength. I also think the instrumentation is interesting because Sean and Matt had done a lot of stuff through Irish Fest and Irish Fest Choir, but there's not a real depth of what I would call Irish traditional instrumentation background or experience, but there's a lot of musical experience here. So I think we've been trying to acquire and immerse ourselves more in the Irish traditional world, but I think there's a real strength here in terms of the instrumentation. And you're right, there's the music that you hear, there's a lot of the same material. So we've really tried to differentiate what we're doing in terms of arrangements. And I think that's something we've really been exploring the last year for sure.
The arrangement of the Fields of Athenry that you just performed for us, I was listening to your bass part and there was almost not a cha-cha rhythm, but there was something very different that you don't normally hear in arrangements of a traditional tune like that.
I don't know
this.
Where I got that from. I just bring a lot of different styles to the table. I play jazz, so maybe that's where it came from.
I think so. There's that great. And of course, Ryan, we don't have the piano today, but I'm sure that adds something as well. I mean, piano usually ends up playing, you know, kind of a rhythm thing, but somehow I suspect that you don't just do that.
Oh, yeah, it's kind of different every time.
But I like that sort of the slightly jazzy, a slightly different, you know, that song I've heard much slower, you know, and you guys have picked up the tempo on that a little bit too.
It's one of the brilliant things about some of these tunes is just like there's so much history behind them and you've heard so many different versions of it. And we want to not only keep true to what the actual tune is about, but at least put our own twist and spin and take on it.
So when you pick a new tune and decide the group, I'm assuming you all vote on what songs you want to do, kind of, sort of.
People very are democratically, not. Yes.
Yeah. So you pick a song. How do you then approach it, the arrangement that you want to do to make it a Tallymore song?
It starts with just the person who brought it to the table and their vision for the song. They need to be instrumental and, no pun intended, with telling us, you know, what they think and where they want it to go. Usually when somebody has a strong vision about the song, that's why we're doing the song. And it makes it easier to arrange and play. And I think we just start simple and just get the format and you know, just run with it a little bit. So
a lot of we start with the vocals?
No. Whoever picks the song usually will come in with a form. And we do a lot of, in rehearsal, a lot of reacting. So I'll play something, Sean will play off of that. And so even if we have sort of an idea in mind of what we want it to be, it's a really organic process to get to the final product. So if it's not always what we envision it from the beginning.
I don't think we're trying to model any particular group or style, and so it's been very iterative. But we found the last year it's really important, as Sean says, when you're developing new material, somebody has to come with a structure and a vision and even concepts about parts. And then everybody else reacts to it. And you have to be willing to have, you know, not too much of a personal stake or not take it as criticism and just kind of as a, you know, a dynamic process that the group's going, what we're going to end up with at the end is going to be a really good product.
I want to hear something else. So what else have we got here? This is another traditional tune,
This is another traditional tune that actually Mr. Dave Kennedy brought to the table recently. This is actually a new tune in our repertoire called The Queen of Argyle.
Gentlemen, is my duty to form you of one beauty, though I'd ask you a favor, not to seek her for a while. My own, she is a creature of character and feature, but no one could paint the picture of the queen of old Argyle. You could have seen her there, boys, if you had just been there. The swan was in a movement, and the morning in her smile. All the roses in the garden, they bowed and asked for pardon, but no one could match the beauty of the queen of old Argyle. On the evening that I mentioned, I passed with a light intention in a part of our dear country known for beauty and for style. In a place of noble thinkers, of scholars and great drinkers, but no one could match the splendor of the queen of old Argyle. Must leave you. My intention's not to grieve you, nor indeed would I deceive you, for I'll see you in a while. I must find my way to gain her, to court her and to tame her, but I fear my heart's in danger of the queen of old Argyle. If you could have seen her there, boys, if you had just been there, the swan was in her movements, and the morning smile. All the roses in the garden, they bowed and asked for pardon, but no one could match the beauty of the queen of old
rocking it out here in the Lake Effect Performance Studio. That was the Queen of Argyle, Tallymore, performing. That was great. What a great version. I really like that arrangement.
Thank you.
Dave Kennedy.
That's you?
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
That's actually pattern. We got to give a little tip of the hat to Brodders and Moore.
Yeah.
Pat Brodders and those guys did that version. It's a really nice one.
It's a great one. It's great. Well, I understand this song is not on your album, but you do have an album.
We do have an album. We launched it actually probably a year ago today. We debuted it at the Milwaukee Irish Festival in 2013, and we're so proud of it. It was such a great experience, a learning experience. We're itching. We're itching to get back already.
So there wasn't a terrible trauma in kind of getting everything done in the studio?
Yeah.
It was very interesting. It was really rushed. We decided we wanted to have it out by Irish Fest, and then we went over to the Excess recording at the Exchange on 35th and National and talked to them. We were like, yeah, we want to have it out by August. And they were like, you can't have it out by August unless you start tomorrow. So we did.
We started tomorrow. Yeah.
We did like 5 12-hour days. It was grueling, but it was really fun. It was definitely a learning experience.
Yeah, and I had to just started playing with the band 2 weeks
yeah,
before.
Yeah, you had to start
so
playing.
You didn't know any of our songs.
I didn't know any of the songs
like,
2 weeks before.
Here's 12 songs. You know,
they just met us like two weeks earlier. We're like, so you want to spend 60 hours with us?
Well, at that point in time, I was just going to come in and play on one tune and ended up playing on several of them. But
So plans to do another one.
Talking about it. Hopefully this time, but yes. Getting the right songs, I think, is very important. And, you know, it's so busy now this time of the year. So once the time has come, you know, once we're more ready and we can actually sit down and talk about it, that would be...
And figure out what you want it
to
sound like and where you want to go. Is there... I know you probably all have day jobs at this point. Is there an idea that this is going to become full-time?
I guess it's just... well, you know, it just depends on the circuit, the festival circuit. And, you know, if we can justify doing it, we would love to. You know, it all comes down to, you know, can we make a living, you know, do enough to get by, so... As soon as we can, I think most of us would like to, you know, not all.
It's definitely a reality. With all of the ethnic genres, I think the Irish Celtic genre is the most commercial and the most accessible to bands. Like, you see all of these really great bands succeeding and doing this full time, so there's definitely hope.
Yeah, and there's an audience out there, so
absolutely.
Hopefully...
Huge audience.
Have you had an opportunity to play and travel outside the U.S. yet, or is it still U.S.-based?
Nothing outside the U.S. Actually, the first year we were even a group, we went out as far west as Seattle, which was a huge venture for us, and actually 2 weekends ago we went as far east as New York. So that was the furthest east we've ever been. So we've probably kind of gone the perimeters of the states, and we'll see if we can push that further now.
I want to thank you all for coming in so early in the morning to perform for us and talk a little bit, and best of luck in the future.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Cheers.
So what are you going to play us out with?
This one's called Go Last You Go. It's one of the songs that they usually play at the end of the scattering at Milwaukee, and it's very dear to my heart and a lot of the other people in this band. So it's Go Last You Go.
Milwaukee-based band Tally Moore playing in Studio C1 in an interview with Bonnie North. The band features Dave Kennedy, Matt Voll, Carl Suchting, Aaron Hoffman, Sean Ward, and Ryan Kaplan. They'll play later this week at Irish Fest, but you can hear all three songs they played for us on our website, wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Our interview was engineered by John Strelecki. That is the Monday edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. So great to have you listening today, as it is every day at this time. I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Coming your way next, it's Fresh Air, and at noon, it's Here and Now.
Will you go, lassie, go, and we'll all go together to pluck wild mountain top.